Chapter 12. Edge People. Rincewind's edge people are a caricature of early hominids, and quite close to what anthropologists used to think Neanderthals were like. We now think that Neanderthals had a bit more going for them, quite apart from burying their dead. At least, it suits the mood of the times to desire to think that they did have something happening behind that big brow ridge. A bone with holes in it, which some archaeologists believe to be a 43,000-year-old Neanderthal bone flute, has been found in Slovenia, but others dispute that it is a musical instrument. Francesco Dorico and Philip Chase have studied the bone carefully, and they are certain that the holes were gnawed in it by animals, not bored by a musically-minded Neanderthal. We don't know if it's been handed to a musician. Whatever the status of the flute, it is clear that Neanderthal culture didn't change significantly over long periods of time. The culture that led to us did. It changed dramatically, and so far, it's never stopped. What made us so different from the Neanderthals? According to the out-of-Africa theory, our ancestors, and everybody else's, came from an original population that evolved in Africa. They migrated through the Middle East. The ones bound for Australia probably left from South Africa, but might have gone round through the Far East and Malaysia. If you've got boats, you can do either. In principle, the immune gene story that we discussed in Chapter 10 could tell us more, but nobody's yet done the research. Either the Australian Aborigines have the same gene spectrum as the rest of us post-bottleneck humans, or they have their own small and characteristic selection instead. Whichever is the case, it will tell us something interesting, but until someone gathers the genetic data, we have no idea which interesting thing it will tell us. A lot of science is like that, a win-win situation. But try explaining that to the bean counters who control research funding. When we speak of migrations in this context, you shouldn't think of the exodus of the Hebrews from Egypt. It wasn't a case of one group of humans taking 40 years or whatever and conquering other hominids along the way. It was more likely the successive formation of small settlements, slowly getting further and further away from the original homeland. The people themselves didn't even know that they were migrating. It was just, "Hey, Alan, why don't you and Marilyn settle down to hunter-gathering a couple of valleys over, by that nice Euphrates River?" Then, after 100 years, there would be a few settlements on the far side of the river too. This isn't pure speculation. Archaeologists have found some of the settlements. If humans formed new settlements a mile away every 10 years, it would take only 50,000 years, a mere 1,000 grandfathers, for them to diffuse from Africa all the way to the frozen north. And they surely diffused faster than that. Hardly anybody actually went anywhere. It was just that the kids set up home a few 100 yards along the track, where there was a bit more room to bring up their kids. As we diffused, we diversified. It is impressive how diverse we are, physically and culturally. But perhaps, from the elvish viewpoint, we're all much the same, from Chinese to Inuit, to Maya, to Welshman. Our similarities are far greater than our differences. This is why we have been forced to invent differences of religious belief, which give us an excuse to kill each other, because they are so dramatically different from us true human beings. They don't even know that spilling salt and then failing to hop 3 times around the table invites a demon into your home, so it's all right to wipe the false humans, them, from the face of the planet. We had diversified in Africa, too, from the tall, willowy Maasai and Zulus to the Kung, Pygmies, and the stout Yoruba. These people are really anciently different. They differ from us and from each other almost as much as wolves differ from jackals. The post-bottleneck humans differentiated quite recently, just as the breeds of dogs differentiated from one kind of wolf, or perhaps it was a jackal. This kind of rapid differentiation is a standard evolutionary story called adaptive radiation. Radiation means spread, and adaptive means that the organisms change as they spread, adapting to new environments, and especially to the changes brought about by their own adaptive radiation. It happened to Darwin's finches, where one small group of finches of a single species arrived in the Galapagos Islands and within a few million years had radiated into 13 separate species, plus a 14th on the Cocos Islands. We wonder what the legend of the 14th finch might be. Another well-known example is the vast array of cichlid fish that diversified in Lake Victoria over the last half a million years or so. There they produced variants for the catfish niche, for the planktonic filter feeder, for the general detritus feeder. They evolved into species with big crushing teeth for eating mollusk shells, species that specialized in scraping scales or fins off other fish, and species that specialized in eating the eyes of other fish. Yes, really. When fish from that species were caught, all they had in their stomachs was eyes. A meal that should see you through the week, as the old music hall joke reminds us. These cichlids ranged in size from a couple of centimetres to half a metre. The original river-dwelling species, Haplochromis bertoni, whose descendants they all are, grows to a length of 10 to 12 centimetres. Curiously, the range of genetics of these fishes was quite small, considering their morphological and behavioural ranges. About the same as out-of-Africa humans, but not as wide as in-Africa humans. At least that's the case according to some reasonable ways to estimate genetic diversity. The second part of this story nearly always involves extinction. Just occasionally, one of the newly differentiated species has evolved a new and successful trick and survives, while all the others perish. But the usual demise of these specialized, adaptively radiated fish happens when a professional specialist, a catfish perhaps, whose ancestors have been feeding on detritus for 20 million years, comes in and takes over from the amateur cichlid catfish. Unfortunately, in this case, it wasn't an inoffensive catfish, but the Nile perch, a specialized carnivore from an ancient stock. The Nile perch has now cleaned out nearly all of the Lake Victoria cichlid explosion, which is why we wrote the previous passage in the past tense. Lakes Malawi and Tanganyika still have their cichlid species flocks. Your local tropical fish shop will have representatives. The main remnants of that glorious radiation of the cichlids are now to be found in the homes of a few amateur hobbyists who are keeping some of the odd cichlid species in aquaria and the Geoffrey Museum in London, which by chance has one of the largest ranges of cichlids and is now sponsored by public bodies. We don't know yet if any of the cichlid variants in Lake Victoria has hit on a trick to survive even the Nile perch. It's difficult to know what Nile perch is about to come in and prune Homo sapiens' current diversity. With luck, it will be our own propensity to miscegenation, aided and abetted by airlines, despite the contrary admonitions of our priests. Maybe we'll all be mixed up into one fairly diverse type, or maybe it will be the Independence Day aliens out to conquer the galaxy, or perhaps more competent ones with elementary virus protection software. Were we the Nile perch for the Neanderthals? What was special about us that they couldn't compete with? In an editorial in Astounding Science Fact and Fiction, John Campbell Jr. proposed that we have been selecting ourselves in very elvish ways from earliest times. Campbell credited his idea to the 19th century anthropologist Lewis Morgan, but in truth Campbell contributed most of the story. It runs, "We select ourselves through puberty rituals and other tribal rites. To some extent, these interact with our religious stories. But as a socializing technique, the puberty ritual may have preceded all but the most basic of animistic beliefs. It certainly sits at the base of our Make a Homo sapiens kit. But the Neanderthals may not have possessed such a cultural kit, at least not in the same effective form. If they didn't, they would probably have been much like Rincewind's edge people, indeed, like all the other great apes, settled and mostly contented in their Garden of Eden, but not going anywhere. What is so special about puberty rituals? What story makes them a necessary part of how we evolved ourselves into the storytelling animal? Just this, said Campbell, puberty rituals select the breeders. This is the standard mechanism of unnatural selection used to breed new varieties of dahlias or dogs, only here it bred new varieties of humans, or stabilized existing varieties. The wizards have always known about unnatural selection, and it is reified on Discworld as the god of evolution in the Last Continent. Unnatural selection is not just a matter of genetics either. If you don't get to breed, then you don't have the opportunity to pass on your cultural prejudices to your children. At best, you can try to pass them on to other people's children. Here's how it works. Over there, we see a group of half a dozen lads, perhaps aged 11 to 14. The older men have prepared an ordeal, and the kids must endure this to become accepted as full members of the tribe, that is, breeders. Perhaps they will be whipped with scorpions or biting insects. Perhaps their faces will be seared with red-hot metal brands. Perhaps, indeed, usually, the older men will violate them sexually. They will be starved, purged, beaten. Oh yes, we are a very inventive species in this regard. Those who ran away were not accepted into the group, and so were not breeders. Going walkabout seems to have been a way to avoid this torture for at least some Australian tribes. So, in particular, they were not our ancestors, because they weren't anyone's ancestors. In contrast, those who submitted to the humiliation were rewarded by acceptance into the tribe. Campbell's insight was that these puberty rituals selected against the immediate animal avoidance of pain response and selected for both imagination and heroism. If I bear this pain now, I will be rewarded by getting the privileges these old men get, and I can imagine that they went through exactly this and survived. Later on, it was the priests who administered the pain. That is how they became the priests, and how successive generations came to respect them and their teachings. By then, humiliation had become its own reward at both ends of the instrument of torture, see small gods, and humans had been selected for obedience to authority. Indeed, Stanley Milgram's book, Obedience to Authority, shows just how obedient we are, by using the authority of a white laboratory coat to force people to torture other people remotely. The other people were actually actors responding to mild, strong, and excruciating pain, or so the experimental subject was led to believe, with the appropriate actions. Milgram's book shows how human beings invented authority and obedience, both very elvish sentiments. That ingredient in the story of our evolution explains Adolf Eichmann, as well as Einstein. We won't go any deeper into that issue here, because we've already covered it in The Privileged Ape and Figments of Reality. A few people refused Milgram's instructions, though, and these mavericks have always been generated, either by experience — some of the refusers had survived concentration camps or had been otherwise tortured themselves — or by the Make-A-Human kit itself. Many of these kits generate a few mavericks, and we are optimistic about the Western one that uses Hollywood films to laud resistance to authority, but perhaps that comes only by working through the right genetics and the right home background. Many of these ancient rituals have become empty now. Jews use circumcision to test the parents' commitment, rather than that of the baby, who has no choice. Jack was the Boston foreskin collector in the early 1960s. It was a very good source of the living human skin samples that he needed for his research on pigment cells in the skin. He saw a lot of parents, many of whom went very pale, and a few of whom fainted. More men did that than women. The Jewish bar mitzvah is very daunting to the child in prospect, though, as with circumcision, nobody fails it, not anymore. But people did fail in the past, with serious consequences. For example, in the ghettos, where only a third of the population married, the mothers of the best girls chose only the boys who performed their bar mitzvah best. This would account for the kind of verbal success that the Jewish faction of many Western populations has achieved. Another explanation, that Jews were permitted verbal abilities only because land or property owning was denied them, is a contextual constraint within which they had to live. Why they were good enough verbally to succeed, despite that constraint, is the interesting question, and bar mitzvah competition and selection of breeders is a persuasive answer. Gypsy populations provide a possible counterexample, though, with very little testing of young men before marriage, which frequently takes place at ages that other cultures consider to be pre-pubertal. The few gypsies who have been successful in Western cultures have not been primarily verbally successful. Music provides a good contrast, with gypsies excelling in dance, while classical composers and instrumental soloists are often Jewish. Of course, gypsies also share our common selective ancestry, if we're right about puberty rites being ancestral and effectively universal. The other great apes don't torture their children for ritual purposes, and the other hominids, like Neanderthals, probably didn't either. So they haven't produced a civilization. Sorry, but that which does not kill us does appear to have made us strong. There is another story that we now tell about what happened to the young men around the time when people were inventing agriculture, which explains barbaric societies. Don't get us wrong here, we don't mean that torturing adolescents is barbaric. It's not, from the tribal point of view. It is an entirely proper way to get them accepted into the tribe. We've done it ever since God on high made the world, and to prove it, here's the holy circumcision knife we've always used. No, from the tribal point of view, the barbarians that we have in mind are awful. They don't have any rules or traditions. Even the Mankhi tribe over that way a couple of miles is better than them. At least the Mankhis have traditions, even if they are different from ours. And we've stolen some of their women, and they have the most amazing tricks. The problem is that lot up on the hillside, the young men who have been expelled from the tribe because they failed the rituals, or went of their own accord, and so failed the test anyway. Couple of my brothers up there with them, and Joel's boy, and of course the four kids that were left when Gertie died. Oh, they're all right on their own. It's when they're in that gang together, all doing their hair in that same funny way to be different, that you lock up your sheep and let the dogs loose. They've got these funny words like honour and bravery and pillage and hero and our gang. When my brothers come down to the valley to my farm by themselves, I give them some food. But some gang of young men, I'm not saying it was that lot and I'm not saying it wasn't, set the Browns farm alight just for the hell of it. In any cowboy film, we find the message that barbarism is opposed to tribalism, that honour and tradition are not good bedfellows, and that having selected himself or herself for imagination, and the ability to endure pain for future pleasure, Homo sapiens is now prepared to die for his or her beliefs, for his or her gang, for honour, for hatred, or for love. Civilization, as we know it, seems to combine elements of both ways of human culture, tribal by tradition and barbaric for honour, for pride. Nations are internally tribal, but present a barbarian face to other nations. Our intelligence tells us stories, and we tell our children stories, and the stories guide us about what to be or do in what circumstances. Shakespeare is the ultimate civiliser in this view. His plays were composed against the barbarian background in a city where you could see heads on spikes and ritually dismembered bodies. All of them were set on the tribal traditional base, that is, most of human life, most of the time. He tells us very persuasively that evil fails in the end, that love conquers, and that laughter, the greatest gift that barbarism brought to tribalism, is one of the sharpest weapons, because it civilizes. Cohens are the hereditary high priest lineage of the Jews. Jack was once asked in Jerusalem whether he was not proud to be a Cohen, in view of the noble Jewish history that the high priest had promoted. Jack sees this nobility as based in about 6 inches of blood in the streets, nearly all of it other people's, so he is not proud. Instead, to the extent that any of us is responsible for what their ancestors did, he is ashamed. He loves small gods in much the way he enjoys the Jewish Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. It engenders a feeling of repentance, and he can always find plenty to repent. He is sure that this emotion, guilt, is a legacy of the Morgan Campbell selection of his ancestors through tribal rituals. Tribesmen aren't proud. For them, everything that isn't mandatory is forbidden. So what is there to be proud about? You can praise your children for doing things right, or admonish or punish them for doing things wrong, but you can't take pride in what you, a fully fledged member of the tribe, do. That comes with the territory. However, you can be guilty about not having done the things that you should have done. Having said that, high priests waging war on dissenters or neighboring tribes, leading to atrocities like heads on spikes, is straight barbarism. The distinction between tribalism and barbarism is illuminated by the story of Dinah in chapter 34 of Genesis. Dinah, an Israelite, was the daughter of Leah and Jacob. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her, and lay with her, and defiled her. Then Shechem fell in love with her, and wanted to make her his wife. But the sons of Jacob felt that maybe Shechem had gone about things in the wrong order. The men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. So when Hamor, the father of Shechem, asked for approval of the marriage and for an intermingling of his tribe with the Israelites, the sons of Jacob came up with a cunning plan. They told the Hivites that they would agree to the proposal, but only after the Hivites had circumcised themselves so that they were just like the Israelites. The Hivites were willing to go along with this because they told themselves that these men are peaceable with us. Therefore let them dwell in the land, and trade therein, for the land, behold, it is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. The decision was made, and every male was circumcised, and all went out of the gate of the city, and they stood around in pain for a couple of days. At that point, Dinah's brothers Simeon and Levi hauled Dinah out of Shechem's house, put all the Hivite men to the sword, destroyed their city, and took all their domestic animals, their wealth, their children, and their wives. This story of deceit and betrayal has not been given much circulation in recent years. It doesn't appeal to people's sense of humor anymore, as it once did. At any rate, in that story, the Hivite response to Shechem's crime is tribal, but the Israelites behave like barbarians. The Hivites, after their initial mistake, want to make amends and coexist peacefully, and they're prepared to offer dowries and other concessions to try to make up for what Shechem did. But all that matters to the Israelites is a twisted kind of honor, in which cruelty, murder, and theft are justified to protect Dinah's reputation. Or more likely, their own sense of manhood. A favorite Discworld character is Conan the Barbarian, a satire on sword and sorcery heroes like Conan the Barbarian. All muscles and troll's teeth necklaces and testosterone-propelled heroism. He first appears in the second Discworld novel, The Light Fantastic. "Hang on, hang on," said Rincewind. "Cohen's a great chap, neck like a bull, got chest muscles like a sack of footballs. I mean, he's the Disc's greatest warrior, a legend in his own lifetime. I remember my granddad telling me he saw him. My granddad. He faltered under the gimlet gaze. "Oh," he said. "Oh, of course. Sorry."
"Yes," said Conan and sighed. "That's right, boy. I'm a lifetime in my own legend."
Conan, by then 87, is the sort of barbarian whose hordes ride into town, set the houses on fire, and look wistfully at the women. But he's no softy. As he ages, he goes hard like oak. In Interesting Times, he explains to Rincewind why, in the area known as the Ramtops, there's no future in the barbarian business anymore.
Fences and farms everywhere. You kill a dragon these days, people complain. You know what? You know what happened?"
"No. What happened?"
"Man came up to me, said my teeth were offensive to trolls. What about that, eh?"
According to Jewish tradition, Kohens are the true Kohanim, the lineal descendants of Aaron. Recent research into the genetics of Coens has turned up some interesting findings about the very prideful, barbaric issue of Coen hereditary. Professor Vivian Moses, yes, indeed, and a group of scientists in Israel decided to check whether the tradition has any factual basis. Just as the mitochondrial DNA sequence traces female heredity, so the Y chromosome, possessed only by males, can be used to trace male heredity. There has been an interesting division of the Jewish peoples, and that provides a scientific check on the story of the Kohanim. During the diaspora, some Jews remained in North Africa, but one large population went into Spain. They are known as Sephardi, and the Rothschilds, Montefiores, and other banking families are all Sephardic. Another, more diffuse population went into Middle Europe, especially Poland, and they are known as Ashkenazi. Moses and his colleagues looked at the Y chromosomes of representative Sephardi and Ashkenazi Kohens and non-Kohens, Israelites. They found characteristic DNA sequences specific to Kohanim in about half of the Kohens that they tested, but with small and characteristic differences in the three groups. From these differences, it is reasonable to suppose that Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jews separated rather less than 2,000 years ago, and that all Kohens were a single group only 2,500 years ago. This looks like a very nice story, with the DNA evidence supporting the expected history. But science is the best guard against believing things because you want to. There is a factor that Moses and his colleagues didn't explicitly consider, and it needs to be explained away, because it makes those figures much too good. Most human groups pretend to practice monogamy. But like swans and gibbons and other creatures that we thought were faithful for life, there are plenty of adulterous relationships and children whose legal and biological parentage differ. In English society, about one child in seven is in that position, and the proportion doesn't differ much between the slums of Liverpool and the stockbroker belt of Maidenhead. Yes, we know you don't believe this, but the first reliable data are in Elliot Phillips's analysis of blood groups from families in high-rise apartments in Liverpool in the late 1960s, published in 1973. There, 10% of the legal paternities were biologically impossible. So, correcting for the cases where the milkman had the same blood group as the legal father, about 13 to 17% were discrepant paternities, as the coy phrase goes. Hundreds of births in Maidenhead in the stockbroker belt yielded the same proportions. American figures for the 1980s were about 10%, but these were underestimates because they were not corrected as the others. That's the thing about science. It tells you stuff you didn't expect. It gets worse, or maybe you feel it gets better. At any rate, many animals that until recently were famed for their fidelity, such as swans, turn out to be partial to a bit on the side. That ubiquitous beast, the monogamous, is rapidly going extinct. The most restrained people that we know in this regard are the Amish of eastern Pennsylvania and other parts of the United States, for whom the figure is a mere 1 in 20. So to err on the safe side, let's assume that all of the Mrs. Kohens from the present day back 100 generations to the sons of Aaron were as well behaved as the Amish. Then the proportion of Kohen males with Aaron's Y chromosome should be 0.95 to the power of 100, which is considerably less than 1 in 100. So how can it be as high as 1 in 2? There is a possible explanation, consonant with what we know about human sexuality, or at least with what John Simons, an expert on human sexual practices, says in his books. According to many surveys of sexual behavior, going right back to Alfred Kinsey around 1950, women practice adultery with men of both higher and lower status. The two situations frequently occur in different social contexts, with women doing favors for higher status men, think Clinton, but going down market for a bit of rough. Overwhelmingly often, however, when a baby results, the father is of a higher status than the woman's husband or regular partner. This implies that if Mrs. Cohen, living in a ghetto or any other predominantly Jewish society, wants to go upmarket, Our only choices are other Cohens. So the maintenance of the Aaron Y chromosome may have been assured by sexual snobbery, rather than amazing fidelity. And that's a much more likely story.